This is the IBJ Podcast for the week of May 20th, 2019. I'm Mason King. I have in front of me a bottle of rosé that was produced in Indiana. Now, of course, if you follow Indiana wine culture at all, you don't need to see the label to guess that it's from Oliver Winery in Bloomington. Established in 1972, Oliver is by far the largest winery in the state. Oliver expects to produce 450,000 cases this year, which is about 1.1 million gallons. And this bottle here is Oliver's Soft Rosé. The winery made its name with this kind of easy-drinking, lip-smacking, fruity wine, and these are still the workhorses in what's now a surprisingly diverse lineup. It includes most of the usual dry whites and reds, like Pinot Grigio and Pinot Noir, as well as semi-dry and semi-sweet wine. Now, one thing that's worth noting, although it's not out of the ordinary for most wineries, is that Oliver does not grow all of its own grapes or the other fruits that it uses. It has a 54-acre vineyard in Monroe County called Creek Bend, and all of the Oliver wines using these grapes are branded as Creek Bend wines. The wines with the Oliver label, and that's the vast majority, are made with fruit from other growers. But all the elements of the winemaking process, including crushing and pressing, fermentation and filtration, all of that takes place at Oliver's operations in Bloomington. And speaking of which, Oliver's campus is surprisingly large, in addition to being beautifully landscaped and manicured. And a huge new addition is almost complete, a 28,000 square foot facility that will be able to hold 50 fermentation tanks, each upwards of 40 feet tall. This additional capacity will be able to push annual production past 1 million cases. And that's the next big goal for CEO Bill Oliver, who, as we'll hear in a few minutes, has been involved with growing grapes and making wine since he was 4 or 5 years old. I made the trek down to Oliver's headquarters to talk with Bill about his connection to winemaking, why he decided to take over the family business, and the milestones that led Oliver Winery to this point. Bill, thank you for hosting me today. I appreciate it.
It's great to be here.
Where are we?
We're at Oliver Winery. Okay. Bloomington, Indiana.
Which part of the winery are we?
Well, we're sitting in a small conference room in our annex building, which houses our administrative team.
Where is the vineyard? When I drove up, I saw look like some token grapes.
You know, that's a fair description. It's a bit bigger than token because it's an acre plus, and we get 6 or 7 tons of good fruit off that. But the majority of our grapes that we grow are grown at Creekman Vineyard, which is 3 miles due west of here, north of Ellettsville, Indiana.
Now, my understanding is that in the 1960s, you helped your dad plant Creek Bend Vineyard. Is that right?
Well, I was present. I think he would probably argue I wasn't helping much because I was 5 years old, but I was out there.
And tell me a little bit about your dad. What was his interest in wine?
Well, you know, he was this eclectic, kind of a jack of all trades, master of none, you know, that cliche, but he just was interested in a lot of stuff. You know, by profession, he was a tax attorney and a tax law professor at Indiana University, but one of the things that he enjoyed doing was making wine in the basement of our home, and that's really what drove the start of the winery. Yes, we went out to Ithaca, New York as a family for him to take a sabbatical year, and on the weekends, we'd all jump in the station wagon and go out to visit the kind of the re-emerging wine industry in the Finger Lakes area. And he was like, by golly, if they can grow grapes in the Finger Lakes, then why can't we in Southern Indiana? I think that was a bit of a stretch of logic there to just say because the same trees grew there, we can grow grapes in Indiana. But it actually has turned out to be a fine place to grow grapes and in many respects better than the Finger Lakes.
Let me jump ahead just for a second. What do you now love most about the winemaking industry?
Just in terms of passion and self-interest, I would say it's the agricultural end. It's the growing grapes. It's the being outside with the earth and starting with a simple nursery stock grapevine and nurturing that into a bearing grapevine over a period of 4 or 5 years and producing wine from it. That is a very kind of a full circle kind of experience, and to be able to turn that into a highly value-added product that people can just love. And we can make a little bit of money on it is special to me. But, my best times now are on a tractor.
Let me go back to that. When I believe it was 1983. So you've just earned a business degree, your undergrad degree.
Oh, yeah.
From Indiana University. What was Oliver Winery like at that time?
Well, it was small. We were about, I would say, 7,000 cases a year back then. We're now 450,000 cases, so a bit of growth since then. And, you know, I think the winery suffered from my father's need to work full-time to support the cash flow at the winery. And I see a lot of wineries like this, and maybe other small businesses are like this. It's someone's dream, and they have a full-time job, and they work their winery or they work their whatever it is on the weekends, and yet they're kind of caught between a rock and a hard place because they're not there full-time to really make sure that everything goes smoothly, but they can't be there full-time because they got to keep their job, their day job, to support the business they started. And when I showed up, you know, kind of the first person with Oliver's last name full-time on site, you know, I didn't really... You know, I just started doing stuff, and it was just a matter of, you know, cleaning the place up and putting up a new sign, and you know, initially just the focus was on how can we sell more wine at the front door, and that was kind of what I thought was the end game, right? We're just going to be a successful retailing winery, going to get people to stop off the highway, or they're going to sell wine, and of course, it's grown well beyond that, but that was the first kind of, you know, business plan for me.
The goal was pretty modest: sell wine at the door.
Oh yeah, and you know, there's some wineries that are, you know, sell giant amounts of wine at the front door, and we sell a pretty good amount out now. And I think that the whole distribution part of it, where we're selling wine from 27 states, just kind of, you know, happened to us, at least initially. But just kind of like, whoa, look at this growing opportunity over here, and then we started paying attention to it, and wow, that's kind of what drives us now. And that's, you know, that's about 93% of our sales right now is what we sell through distribution.
If we go from 83 to today, were there one or two decisions that you think were the most impactful, most important to get to where you are today?
One is, I think, starting early on and understanding that winery visitation is not about selling wine. It's about providing a customer experience. And that's been, you know, and it's kind of a duh, you know, for, I think, really. But it's not patently obvious to a 23-year-old when he gets out of business school. And that's still an ongoing process to make sure that that visitor experience is outstanding, and that ultimately the goal of the people leave with wine, that we forge a long-term relationship with consumers because of their positive experiences they had at the winery. I would think also in terms of what kind of the evolution of our thinking is to be very goal and stylistically consistent in our winemaking philosophy, that we really become, you know, sort of thinking about where does Oliver Winery fit in the world of wine, and being very deliberate about making the right wines for the consumer that's open to a wine made in an unusual place like Bloomington, Indiana.
If I'm remembering the map of your vineyard correctly, you've got at least 20 varieties. Am I even saying?
Yeah, I think
right?
You're probably looking at 20 blocks that are are maybe more like a dozen varieties. And we've actually simplified that over the years. And we really a mindset to explore what's possible with Indiana grown fruit, Indiana and wine made from Indiana grown fruit. Mm-hmm. And not everything worked. Right. I mean, there were things that didn't work from a viticulture point of view, like the winter hardiness or disease resistance or some other just functional thing in the vineyard didn't work. Or maybe it was the wine. Maybe it was like we were growing a variety that people really aren't, they're not buying it. All right. I mean, literally at the end of the day, as we joke, that the cash register is going to drive those decisions because it doesn't matter how much I like it. If the consumer's not buying it, that's probably not something we need to continue to do. So we've reduced the number of varieties at Creek Bend. Probably by 30% in the last several years.
Well, it seemed like you have a pretty diverse product line. I mean, you have some of the more conventional dry wines. I mean, there's a Cabernet Sauvignon, there's a Sauvignon Blanc, there's a Merlot, there's, all the basic stuff you'd see. And then there is the, you describe what the balance of the
as winemakers, it drives us crazy because we do make just about everything from just your classic vinifera, kind of a California, you know, tasting room set. Most of the grapes that we grow at Creek Bend are intra-specific varieties, better adapted to our climate, and make really interesting wines, really beautiful wines, and distinct from vinifera. I think it's a positive quality. I think in a world where people are looking for something new, that they should be excited about what we're selling out of Creek Bend, which would be grapes like Chambersin and Crimson Cabernet, Cabernet Doré, beautiful new grape varieties that thrive here. And then we move into a lot of the sweeter wines that really kind of keep the lights turned on here, frankly. You know, the soft collection, soft red, white rosé, which has been kind of our workhorse here for decades. And then newer wines, we have seasonal wines that are like apple pie, peach pie,
And then the Moscatos that we're making now that are just on fire. It's kind of crazy. We're up multiple hundreds of percent for like a blueberry and cherry Moscato, which are fruit juices, not flavors, but fruit juices added to Moscato wine.
What's happening to the market? Why are those types popular right now?
You know, there has been a legitimization of sweet wines that's happened. And I like to say we caused it, but I don't think we did. But I think a lot of the big players got into the sweet wine business and sort of like said, hey, it's okay to like sweeter wines. And Moscato being kind of the champion of that, you know, in the sweet wine world right now. And we do it really, really well. I mean, we're just great winemakers. And our, you know, our Moscato is beautiful. The fact that we're just really thoughtful about what we want wine to taste like. We don't want it to be cloyingly sweet. We want it to be balanced. We want the flavors to be prominent, but not kind of knock you over, kind of subtle. I think they're sort of sweet wines with a bit of sophistication and then really good branding. They're going to make the bottle beautiful.
Hey, this is a good point in the conversation to take a quick break. This is the IBJ podcast, and we'll be right back.
The IBJ podcast is sponsored by Nimbo IP, Indiana's top cloud solutions provider for voice, data, IT, and network security. Nimbo IP has proudly served Hoosier businesses since 1989. Let its innovative solutions put your business on the right path, plan, and platform for the future. Nimbo IP has been named one of America's best VoIP providers by Enterprise Networking Magazine. Call them today for a complimentary technology assessment at 317-574-1000 or visit them on the web at www.nimboip.com. Nimbo IP, your solutions in the cloud.
Welcome back. I'm Mason King. Again, I'm with Bill Oliver, CEO of Oliver Winery. What does the customer experience mean to you? I mean, when I drove in here, I was really struck by how manicured everything seems.
You know, we love it. We love gardening, and just getting our hands dirty with plants is just great. But I part of it is like setting positive expectations for people, right? I mean, you want to set people in the right frame of mind. I remember a restaurateur telling me that the attitude of his host or hostess could make the food taste better or worse if they got off on the wrong foot.
And the main tasting room. It seems like there are a lot of the sort of points for people to be.
We did a major renovation. We were shut in January and just really kind of fine-tune that place and just brighten it up. Added a big glass wall on the north side overlooking the pond. And yeah, there's a lot of like visual candy that's there, but not too much. You know, it's the right balance. We actually sort of simplified things. We took some clutter out and trying to find the right place. We want people to know they're in a winery tasting room when they walk in, not a gift shop.
You mentioned that how much wine Oliver currently produces. What is that number again?
Backward looking, 12 months. That's where we are, 430,000 cases. But, you know, we've got some big months in front of us and some phenomenal growth items right now. And I think we'll end up in a calendar year in 2019 at 450 to 460,000 cases.
How many gallons is that?
Well, multiplied by 2.38, like 1,150,000, somewhere in that kind of number. And that was the Wine Business Monthly, which is kind of our big national trade magazine, put us at 44th largest U.S. winery.
And by far the biggest in Indiana.
By far.
But 44th right. In the nation is 44th
in the nation.
And you mentioned your sales reach. Where in the United States can I find Oliver Wines?
Well, we're 27 states, and I would, you know, draw, you know, Colorado up to, you know, the Dakotas and Texas over to Florida, up to Connecticut and Massachusetts, with a few holes. There's just a couple places we've not gone into because we didn't have the right distributor alignment, or maybe there were some state laws, some regulations, or we felt like the population density didn't really worth servicing that market. Because when we go into a place, we got to think, all right, is there enough people there for us to send a sales guy in, right? Mm. I mean, that kind of like rules out Wyoming. If you take a look at giant wine markets like Texas and Florida, you know, that's a no-brainer, right? There's a lot of people you can get to and make it worth your while.
How long ago was it just an Indiana operation?
2000.
Okay.
Year 2000, when we built a new building because we had some inquiries from Illinois and Kentucky both about from distributors about potentially going to those markets, and put up a big new production building, and then we're quickly in about another 8 states.
Is it just about finding the right distributor?
It's a lot about finding the distributor, absolutely. And you know, it's a challenge for all wineries when a distributor has 500 or 1,000 brands in their book and their portfolio of things they sell is how do you get their share of mind? And, you know, especially for the new guy, come knocking on the door, hey, we want you to sell our wine. They're like, why? In Indiana, we're a big brand. In Ohio, we're a fairly big brand. In Kentucky, we're a big brand. And their distributors are, you know, eager to hear what we have to say and work hard for us. And we get way further afield where we're kind of the new guy or a smaller player, and it's tougher to get that share of mine. That's completely understandable.
Did I read this right, that I can get your wines at Target?
Yep, Target, you know, all the big chains, of course, and that's, you know, across the country, that's where the majority of wine is sold. So we've got good relationships with Target and Kroger and the Walmart organization and Meijer and HEB in Texas and down the list.
Wow, how do you do that?
Well, we've got a person that's dedicated to that. We call a key account manager, and the key account manager is responsible for managing those relationships and making those appointments and traveling to talk to them. It mostly boils down to you have a compelling product. I mean, we could talk about, you know, how do you sell stuff, and it doesn't matter if the buyer for Walmart or Target or you name it, you hand them the bottle of wine, they look at it and go, I've already got 400 of these, why do I need yours? But you come in with something unique and that they just instinctively know, oh yeah, this would sell. And then we also come in with data, and that's a big thing. You know, success breeds success. And I've got, you know, Indiana sales data that would help me make my argument in Ohio. And if I'm successful there, then it just kind of like, I would call it dominoes into the next state. You know, in Texas, we've got a private label product called Porch Swing, which HEB sells, which has done, you know, remarkably well. And HEB is the big player in Texas grocery. Because that's worked well for them, they're a lot more likely to respond to our emails, take our phone calls, and let us come in for an appointment, right, to talk about the next product, which, you know, we exploit those opportunities. So,
So my understanding is, in terms of goals, the next big one is to hit 1 million cases.
That's a few years away, you know, but solid growth will get us there. You know, we're, you know, knocking on 500,000. I don't think that's tough. You know, we've got a building under construction that is a 1 million case facility.
That sounds deceptively simple. Let's just build a bigger building.
Yeah, you know, we've got a history of that, though. We got a history. I remember the bottling line we built in 2000, which is still substantially the bottling line we use today, which I call, like, you know, the Hail Mary pass of the year 2000. I'm just like, hope this goes well. You know, it's all about, you know, how much risk you want to take, and, you know, and I think we've been appropriately bold.
Yeah, so we walked by this building when we were walking here to the office. And about how close is it to being finished?
Oh, we're months. I would expect that this would be fully operational by the end of the summer. Yeah, and that's when the fruit juice starts rolling in, right? Yeah. So that's kind of, you know, you imagine all across the country, there are wineries that are scrambling to be ready by August, right?
And again, this building will allow you to do what?
It is to grow. Mm-hmm. The building we're building right now is based upon a realistic sales outlook and what kind of resources do we need. What capital expenditures do we need to make to be able to satisfy that sales projection?
I think you said it was a million case building. Is that how
you put it? Well, we're going to have, you know, it is. We're not pulling all the tanks in there initially, but when it's fully outfitted, we have currently about 1.4 million gallons of tank capacity. That building will hold 1.8 million gallons. So yeah, right, more than doubling our tank capacity. A new bottling line will go in there. Winemaking offices.
According to your projections, how quickly could you get to 1 million cases a year?
5 years?
Wow. Double in 5 years?
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, that's not that much of just of a compounded growth rate.
How much is the investment?
$8.5
million. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I would assume that's your biggest single investment in the history of the business.
Yeah, this is the great Hail Mary toss of 2019. So come back in 5 years.
Is that cash you had in your back pocket, or did you have to get financing?
It is. We are a bank debt free organization.
Is that right? So you really paid in cash?
Yeah, we are very proud of our financial statements. I mean, that we can pay as we go. Boy, you sleep better, don't you? Mm. You really do. And that's not to say we were always that way, but currently we're a self financed organization.
How many employees do you have right now?
105.
Now you and I. See if I got the year right. 2006 became, according to your website, 100% employee owned. What does that mean?
Yeah, we are an ESOP. My wife and I made that decision in 2006 to do that. It was, you know, that was a personal decision with a whole lot of factors weighing into it. But it looked like the way for us to transition the business in the best interest of ourselves and our employees was to become employee owned. And you know, you could talk about ESOPs and how they're structured forever, and it's a fairly complicated legal kind of structure, but really what the winery operates at is now as a retirement plans for the current employees.
How old are you?
59.
Are you at the point where you have a succession plan already?
Well, the ESOP is a succession plan in terms of what? In terms of ownership? So that's it.
Yeah, if you get hit by lightning on the tractor tomorrow.
The succession plan is now kind of from a management structure has been fully executed. There is absolutely no, I feel like I'm important around here and my input is valued that were I to be abducted by aliens this afternoon, Oliver Winery would continue to thrive.
Okay, well, on that morbid note, we'll end the discussion. Thank you so much, Bill. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's been fun. Thank you so much.
My thanks again to Bill Oliver. Hey, before you get on with your week, I wanted to draw your attention to some of the other lead stories in this week's edition of IBJ. Reporter Mickey Shuey runs through a plan to extend a recreational trail in Speedway that community leaders say will jolt property values and spur development in several aging neighborhoods. Also in this week's issue, John Russell explains why state officials, who long have boasted how Indiana is one of the most business-friendly states in the nation, are planning on raising permit fees from levels established 25 years ago. And Lindsay Erdody details how state legislators have established rules for the fledgling car-sharing industry. It's not so much Uber or Lyft as it is budget or enterprise, but with an Airbnb twist. And again, you can find all these stories in the copy of IBJ that you undoubtedly have delivered to your home or office and at IBJ.com as well. And remember, to get unfettered access to all of IBJ's award-winning business content, just hit the subscribe button. Thanks again for making time for the IBJ podcast, which is edited by Leslie Weidenbender. I'm Mason King, and we'll be back again next week.